we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Who should decide if we are dead, man or God? I'm Dr. Marilyn Singleton, and welcome to America Out Loud Pulse. We are always a beat ahead. Our brave new world of medicine can keep people alive who at an earlier time wouldn't have survived. But prediction of death or a high probability of death is not the same as death. Defining death matters most importantly to the living human being who's being declared dead. It also matters for a variety of reasons having nothing to do with medical care. We've got life insurance, homicide charges, wrongful death lawsuits. Of course, medically, health professionals think of maintaining organs for donation, and the holders of the purse strings think of so-called wasted resources. But a bigger reason is defining the limits of our humanity and the status of our souls. When does a patient cross the line between life and death? The Uniform Determination of Death Act was created in 1981 in an attempt to resolve that question. It's called the UDDA for short, and it's a model state law, and it has been adopted in some form by almost all the states. Kind of hard to believe, but it was approved by the American Medical Association, the American Bar Association, and the President's Commission for the Study of Ethical Problems in Medicine and Biomedical and Behavioral Research. What a mouthful. The Act defines death as irreversible cessation of circulation or of brain functions. Well, now it's in the process of being revised. And the bothersome thing is one suggestion is to change the word irreversible to permanent. I mean, you don't have to be a doctor or a scientist to know there's a difference between those words. Another is to allow a bedside determination of death without any laboratory testing. To me, these changes seem to make it easier to ration care and make more organs available for transplant. Today, my guest is a pioneer in neonatology and perinatology. He's a pioneer in saving babies who were given up as certain to die. He's been writing on matters of life and death for over 40 years. Dr. Paul Byrne is a board-certified neonatologist and perinatologist and clinical professor of pediatrics at the University of Toledo. He is president of Life Guardian Foundation and past president of the Catholic Medical Association in the United States. He was invited to present at the Pontifical Academy of Sciences in the Vatican. He protected and defended the lives of many children who were considered dead. I don't usually say anything non-professional when I give the bio, but Dr. Byrne's family ties are worth repeating. He was married to his wife for 48 years until she passed away several years ago. They were blessed with 12 children, 36 grandchildren, and 5 great-grandchildren. I guess you could say he practiced what he preaches about loving life. Welcome to the show, Dr. Byrne.
Marilyn, thank you very much for inviting me to be on your program. I consider it an honor to be part of all the work that I know that you do, especially with the American Academy of Physicians and Surgeons. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, and it's an honor for you to come. First, I'm just going to ask you, how did you get interested in saving these premature babies?
Well, when I was a very much younger doctor and practicing as a pediatrician when a baby was born prematurely and had difficulty with breathing. We would do whatever it is we could do, and basically amounted to coming back the next day, or at the very most 2 days later, and pronounced the baby dead. There was really no treatment. In fact, of the matter is, when I started, every baby 1,500 grams or 3 pounds and 4 ounces who had difficulty with breathing died. It was 100% mortality. And it just seemed to me that there should be something we could do. I was at St. Louis University and Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. So I went to the administrator and said, can we start a special care nursery for sick babies? And so perhaps not immediately, but in a relatively short time, she said, all right, let's do it for a year and let's see what happens. Well, in that first year, I got more than 30 babies referred to me. And by the time I left that position, I was getting more than 600 babies from more than 50 hospitals in that surrounding area of in Missouri and Illinois and thereabouts. But what then happened, and we actually were, I would say, one of the leaders in the development of care of babies. We were the ones that did a lot with helping to develop the ventilator. We were the ones that invented how to take care of how to do blood pressure on premature babies. I worked with the astronauts. We took the blood pressure cuff from the astronaut's finger and moved it up to the arm of the premature baby and invented the way to take blood pressure. We were the ones that invented some of the aspects of parental nutrition. We identified the need for magnesium. We identified the need for copper. And the need for zinc in parental nutrition. So there I was in the middle of that kind of academic environment, and a baby by the name of Joseph was delivered and came under my care. His mother said he was 18 weeks in gestation, and even though I tried to push a bit to see if it was more than that, she would never say that Joseph was any more than 20 weeks. But in any event, Joseph was put on a ventilator shortly after birth. And after several weeks, Joseph would be there and do little in the way of anything and continued on the ventilator. So it was suggested to do a brainwave test. The brainwave test was done, and the report says consistent with cerebral death. So I can recall looking at that death on his chart and looking at Joseph and saying he wasn't dead. So I said to the neurologist, what do I do now? And he said, well, just repeat it in a good length of time. I said, how long? He said, well, 24 hours. So we repeated it in 48 hours, and it was unchanged from the previous one. So I said, what do we do now? And he said, well, in some places they turn off the ventilator. And I said, well, I don't do that. I said, I treat babies, and you have to know I was in this thing of taking care of sick babies when many babies died, and that kind of thing. So we really were just getting into when we could do some things to help some babies at that time. And I said, well, I don't do that. I continue to treat Joseph. And eventually he did get off the ventilator. He went to school. He got good grades. He ran track and played baseball. He subsequently married, has 3 children. Well, because of Joseph, and I I have to tell you that I didn't start to study brain death immediately that day when I saw that on his chart, but it stayed in my mind. And when Joseph was about 6 months old, it was on my mind. And I said to the same neurologist, I said, Harvey, please give me some articles about brain death. So that's when it started. It took me about 2 years to understand the language of brain death, the language of death, and what goes on. It's I would say relatively simple if we think in terms of death. All of us know what death is, from when a relative dies or our pet dog, cat, would die, or we walk in the woods and find a dead bird thereabout. So we know what dead is from that regard. And yes, when someone is dead, there's a loss of function, but it's due to destruction. And so you see, if you go from death and you come back, you get into destruction and you come back further, there's an absence of function. And the so-called brain death laws, the Uniform Determination of Death Act, what it's based on is an absence of function of the brain. Well, an absence of function of the brain is not necessarily destruction of the brain, much less death of the person. And the way in our ordinary way of life, we do not have ourselves so disciplined in how we think and that kind of thing. We put things together. And so we see Uniform Determination of Death Act. We see death, the word death. We think in terms of death. And then we go look at the law. And what the law says, that an individual, incidentally, it says individual, it doesn't say an individual person, it just says an individual can be dead in one of two ways. And the one way has to do with the cessation of the cardiorespiratory functions, and the other one has to do with the cessation of brain functions, and then they make them equivalent when in fact they're not equivalent. If somebody has an absence of the circulatory respiratory functions, so that the circulatory respiratory functions are destroyed, the brain won't function and it won't ever function again. And just like if somebody is dead, the brain won't function and won't ever function again. But then in the second part of the Determination of Death Act, it uses very strong language. I would say strong language. Irreversible is a key word, but go from there. Irreversible cessation of all functions, including the brainstem, is dead. So all functions of the entire brain, including the brainstem, and then you mentioned the President's Commission, the study of ethics and those kinds of things. What they said is that the functions that are considered are those that are relevant to the clinical situation, the clinical ascertainment of death. So whatever was meant by the words cessation of all functions of the entire brain, and then they included the brainstem, and one that knows anything about the brain would say, if it's all functions of the entire brain, then why do you have to put in the brainstem? But in any event, they did. If someone is dead by the number two thing, they always, all of those patients that have a declaration of brain death, they They all have a beating heart and circulation and respiration. They digest food. They have their body temperature is sustained. And those patients, that they're called dead, but they have all of those things, but they're not dead according to the first one. And so the law was there. The law is going on, and I've told you a few things about the law. But then what they want to do now is they want to modify the law. And part of how they see a need to modify the law is because in the cases that have come up, when it's brought to the attention of the court, that it says cessation of all functions of the entire brain, and yet patients who are declared brain dead and have this cessation of what they call all functions of the entire brain, they still have some functions of the brain. In the case of Aiden Helu was a 20-year-old girl in Nevada, a college student, developed abdominal pain, went to the emergency room. She then had appendicitis was a question. She then had an exploratory laparotomy, which not an open, but via the scope. And when they did not find appendicitis, they did not find anything else, but she didn't wake up after her anesthetic. So they then said that she was brain dead. The father was astute enough to go to the court and become the guardian of his daughter. Incidentally, just to interject things that are in there, anybody who is over the age of 18 has to document an agent or someone to speak for them, or else they're subject to the possibility of the court appointing whomever. But
Dr. Byrne, I'm going to stop you right there. And I feel like we're on a big cliffhanger, and pick up the story after we take our short little break.
These days, every time you turn on the news, it seems like there's a new threat to your health. Maintaining a strong immune system has never been more critical. Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created Immune Super Boost to help you strengthen your immunity. Unlike other supplements that don't work, Immune Super Boost is not a pill. It's a gel you swallow with ultra absorption of science-backed nutrients proven to support immunity, like vitamin C, D3, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea. These physician-formulated gels come in a small gel pack. Tear off the top and shoot it down, or mix it in water. Boost your immunity. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
So, sorry to have to stop you there, Dr. Byrne. This is quite a story. So please continue. After the girl's father went to the court, so, what happened?
So her father was the guardian. And so then the doctors declared Aiden Helu dead. in accord with the American Academy of Neurology guidelines. So they had done an EEG three times on Ada Nalu, and at no time was she without electrical activity. So when it got into the court system with bringing to the attention of the of the court the presence of EEG activity, and the doctors said it was in accord with the American Academy of Neurology guidelines, it then went to the Supreme Court in Nevada. And the Supreme Court in Nevada issued a 7-0 unanimous decision that they could not determine that it was in accord with those guidelines or with accord with any other criteria for declaration of brain death. And they specifically mentioned the Harvard criteria. And they referred it back to the lower court. And so before it could be heard again at the lower court, they Aiden died. Aiden then was dead. But for that whole time, those many months, Aiden continued to live, but then was dead. And so then what happened subsequent to that is they went back to the legislators in Nevada and got put into the legislation that it is the Academy of Neurology guidelines. They also put in there in that they the doctors did not have to notify the relatives that they were going to do these tests for brain death. And they also put in there that if someone objects to the declaration of brain death while their relative, whether it's son, their daughter, still has a beating heart and circulation, and they do not accept that their daughter, in this case, it would have been Aiden Helu, the father did not accept that Aiden was truly dead. And so what the law put in there is that if someone objects, they may be subject to all the medical and legal financial things that occur after their objection. And basically they put into the law that it makes it, you know, very difficult for someone to say, well, I don't accept that what you're saying about brain death and the like. And so these things are going on. And of course, I told you about Joseph, and there's Aiden Helu. Jahi McMath, the 13-year-old girl in California who had tonsil surgery. Post-tonsil surgery, there was hemorrhage, and then they said she was brain dead. Her mother got on the television and said, will someone help me? So I went to California and help with Jahi McMath. We got her transferred from California to New Jersey. In California, she had death determined and a death certificate was signed for her. And so far as the Academy Neurology guidelines and the like that were followed, at least three doctors on the staff at the hospital said she fulfilled them. A consultant from Stanford that was appointed also said that the guidelines were fulfilled. And not only that, they said the technetium scan that was used was consistent with brain death. Well, when I went to see Jahi, the hospital wouldn't even call her by name. They referred to her as a dead body. When we got her out of that hospital, they wouldn't even allow a sheet from the hospital to go with her. We had to get her out in the middle of the night, get her to New Jersey. where she did get the tracheostomy and the PEG tube. Incidentally, the only way that a patient can get out of an intensive care unit on a ventilator is with a tracheostomy. And so they wouldn't do that in California, but she went to New Jersey and got that, continued to get treatment. Jahai lived more than 4 years in New Jersey in spite of the death certificate, and in California that, and she lived at home. It wasn't so terribly costly to take care of a patient at home. She lived at home. She got to where her mother would say, "Give me a thumbs up," and she would raise her thumb. When the mother would say, "Raise your left leg," and she would raise her left leg, clearly indicating that she had some functioning of her brain. And so Jahai McMath is another patient that I had the privilege of participating in her treatment and care. And so again, a lot of notoriety about Jahai McMath. The other patients that I participated with, not so much notoriety, but they all have some evidence of some functioning of the brain in some way when you go to look at it. The President's Commission said those functions that are relevant to the clinical ascertainment. So the functions of the brain, like even maintaining a normal temperature. When somebody is dead, their temperature equilibrates with the room temperature relatively quickly. All of these patients have a temperature. They all have a blood pressure. They all have a beating heart. In fact, of the matter is, those are declared brain dead. When they cut on them to take their organs, their heart rate goes up and their blood pressure goes up. Obviously they want the anesthesiologist there to perhaps give some anesthetic, but also to do other things to be supportive and that kind of thing. But there's no response to a corpse. There's no response when the pathologist does an autopsy. Yet in these patients that are declared brain dead, they do have evidence of response. And another thing that happens when the brain doesn't function, the hypothalamus doesn't function. Yet many of these patients that are declared brain dead have a functioning hypothalamus, have functioning thyroid stimulating hormone, have salt and water balance. And so part of what the recommendation in the changing of the Uniform Determination of Death Act is to make it so they don't have to check for these endocrine hormonal functions, just strike them from being relevant. And even now, when they do test, they test for thyroid stimulating hormone as a screening test, and saying that if somebody has hypothyroidism, they have an elevated TSH. Many of these patients have a normal TSH, but what happens to them, they don't have very much of it. It goes down. And so they don't have enough thyroid hormone. The thyroid hormone gets depleted quickly without the TSH, and their hypothyroid. And these patients do not have thyroid sufficient to give them good circulation, good blood pressure, to reduce the swelling that they might have in their body or in their brain. These kinds of things are going on. And so the revision of the Uniform Determination of Death Act is to get away from those things that have been going on in terms of looking for absence of functions that they consider as non-relevant, like the EEG. The EEG became non-relevant early on in the development of these things. The first brain death article in the United States literature in JAMA was in 1968. In 1971, there was an article published that concluded that no longer did the neurosurgeon need to do EEG recording to determine the question of brain death. And you read that article and you find out that they had 9 patients, 2 of the 9 still had brainwave activity. And then the conclusion was no longer is it necessary to do brainwave testing before you declare somebody dead. Well, that's part of what went on in my own experience with the reason for investigating brain death is because I found that it's not based on adequate science that would be adequate for any other advancement in medicine.
Well, it's interesting you talk about the EEG and measuring the brain waves, because I remember back then and people were saying, well, you could get brain waves from a bowl of Jell-O, so that doesn't mean that the person has any brain activity. What do you say when people say stuff like that?
Well, the EEG, the first thing it does, it's important to know that it records electrical activity only from the outer centimeter, at the most centimeter and a half of the brain. It doesn't do any evaluation of anything deeper in the brain than that. And so recording of brain waves is a way of measuring brain activity electrically. And what the reason that they don't want to do brainwave activity recording anymore is because many of the patients have some kind of activity, and so it makes it more difficult. You have to know that the law says irreversible cessation of all functions of the entire brain, and yet everyone is aware of the fact that some functions of the entire brain are always there in the patients that are called brain dead, in terms of their body temperature and having TSH there. Maybe 50% of the patients have thyroid stimulating hormone that's made in the hypothalamus, and which is a part of the brain. And so what do you do with these things? So things like terms like brain dead gets used loosely, somewhat jokingly sometimes, and the use of the term brain dead is really brainwashing, because what happens is we get exposed to the term brain dead, and many people know more about death than they do the functions of the brain, and that kind of thing. So they hear death, and then many of the discussions get into a so-called definition of death, when in fact what it is it's criteria that doctors use to declare death. And the way that doctors did in the past, so far as declaration of death was concerned, and incidentally, in the past, it was only a doctor who could certify death. It still might be that, but on the other hand, they turned this thing over to some other people, but other than doctors that happen to be on the team. But the way that a doctor would declare someone dead, he would not declare them dead unless there was no heartbeat, there was no circulation, there was no respiration, there was no response. And then the doctors knew to be cautious. The doctors knew to wait a period of time and that kind of thing, and not to be in a hurry. The question is, what were they waiting for? Well, in terms of understanding what we know now about the brain and death and that kind of thing, I would have to ask the question, weren't they really waiting for destruction? Destruction sufficient that it would be a way that it would certify death? It wasn't just on an absence of the functioning of the heart or an absence of the functioning of a response, but it was something more than that. And what is that? And
we're going to have to find out the answer to what that was after the break. And this whole discussion, I know it's uncomfortable, but it's something people need to know. After all, our Constitution does give us the right to life. And so we will continue this discussion after our brief break. I just want to thank everyone for listening to America Out Loud Pulse. You know, we are always a beat ahead. We've got our free apps on Apple and Android and Alexa, and you can hear us every weekday at 5 p.m. with an encore at 11 p.m. That's Eastern Time, and on iHeartRadio at 8 a.m. the next morning. All shows go direct to podcast in 24 hours, and the episodes are on lots of podcast networks, Apple and Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, Stitcher, and iHeart. One thing I really like about the show is that it's different every night. I'm on Mondays. Tuesdays has concerned doctors, Dr. Jordan Vaughn and Dr. Stuart Tankersley. Wednesdays with Dr. Peter McCulloch of Malcolm Out Loud. Thursdays with Dr. Peter Bregan and Ginger Ross Bregan. Everyone with different specialties and variety of talks.
Was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow that said, "Lives of great men all remind us we can make our lives sublime and departing, leave behind us footprints on the sands of time." America Out Loud Talk Radio, liberty and justice for all.
You already know Genesis plus HOCL is your best defense against viruses. But did you also know it's the most powerful weapon for eliminating airborne mold, too? Customers are raving about the Genesis Fogger's ability to tackle mold problems and the bad smells that go with them. And we all know mold is a hazard to your health. There's no airborne invader that Genesis can't handle. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud to receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you're ready for anything.
We wouldn't go a day without washing our hands, brushing our teeth, and washing our nose. Well, wait, we wash our nose? Yes, the number one place where bacteria, viruses, and pollen enter the body is through the nose. So the average person breathes over 23,000 times a day. That's 23,000 opportunities for bacteria, viruses, and irritants to get into your nose and make you sick. For an extra layer of protection, wash your nose with Clear. That is Clear, X-L-E-A-R. Clear's drug-free nasal spray features xylitol, an ingredient proven to block adhesion of many nasty bacteria and viruses, and effectively clean, not just rinse like a saline, but wash your nose. Clear nasal spray quickly alleviates congestion, opens your airway, and ensures your body's natural defenses are strong. Read the research studies for yourself at clear.com. That's X-L-E-A-R.com. Protect yourself from the pathogens and junk you breathe. Pick up a bottle for you and your family today.
So, sorry to have to interrupt you, Dr. Byrne. Do go on. And so, what's the question? Why do they have to define this, and I'm going to say it in quotes, death this way?
Well, so far as the definition of death is concerned, it has to do with when life on earth ends. And everything about death has to do with disintegration, dissolution, destruction, and yes, there is an absence of the functioning, whatever that is, the functioning of the brain or the heart or whatever it is, an absence of that, but it's because of the destruction that's there. That life is a living state, and then the event of death comes along and changes the life to the dead remains. So death happens, and then the life changes to the dead remains, and what is left on earth are the remains of someone, and we know about that in terms of when some one of our relatives die or that kind of thing, or going to awake, and there's no question but that body is dead, it's cold, there's no response, and that kind of thing. People know what death is. And so what happened, they did a heart transplant in South Africa. Christian Bernard did the first heart transplant in South Africa. And those of us that are a bit older remember that. That was the headlines all over the place. And people remember that first heart transplant. What about the second one? Who remembers the second one? The second one was done 3 days later. Where was it done? It was done in Brooklyn, New York. And what did they do? They cut the beating heart out of a 3-day-old baby who had an absence of some functioning of the brain, and transplanted it into an 18-day-old baby. And at the end of their procedures, both babies were dead. It was immoral. It was illegal. And so what did they do to make this become legal? They appointed a committee at Harvard. So the Harvard committee began their work. The babies in Brooklyn, New York that we're talking about were at the end of, it was in December of 1967. In 68, they appointed the committee at Harvard and published their result in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 1968. And the title of their article is A Definition of Irreversible Coma. Now, someone in coma is unresponsive, but we wouldn't call somebody in coma dead. And then what they did is they put the word irreversible in there, and to get into that, what can a doctor do? A doctor can observe an absence of the functioning. And even a doctor can observe destruction, disintegration, but a doctor can't observe irreversible. So it's not an empiric term that doctors can do. But in any event, a definition of irreversible coma, and you got to put this in perspective that I had Joseph in 1975, that I took care of. You got to know, I was a doctor in 1968. There were these things that are happening about brain death, but I trusted the neurologist. I trusted the doctors. Then Joseph came along, and that caused me, because on Joseph's chart, it says consistent with cerebral death, that caused me to look into it. And the article, the first article in 1968, I looked into it, that there were no references. That there was one reference, and that was to Pope Pius XII, but there were no references to basic science studies. There were no references to clinical studies. It was just published. And then they put right up front, why did they have to have this this new way to declare somebody dead? And they gave as their number one reason, because intensive care units would get crowded. Let me tell you something about the development of an intensive care unit, which I did at Cardinal Glennon Children's Hospital. When we got a new piece of equipment, and then we got the second one, and then the nurse would say, what are you going to do if you get the third patient? I'll say, just like we did before, we'll keep treating the third one until we find a better way or more equipment. But and what did we do with the development of intensive care units? When we need more of them, we got more. I mean, we just went through the COVID thing, and they were talking about the need for respirators, as they called them, and they invented all kinds of them. They talked about hospital beds. They got all kinds of hospital beds. But the article, Definition of Irreversible Coma, says they need this. Number one reason is because intensive care units get crowded. The number two reason was that there would be controversy in the taking of organs. And so they had that, and they put it as number two, but it was really the reason for their invention of brain death. And it truly was an invention. It wasn't based on basic science. It wasn't based on clinical patients. And they gave a reference to Pope Pius XII, but they quoted one part of Pope Pius XII said, but what he did say that they didn't quote, we are to presume that human life continues as long as vital functions are present, even when supported by artificial means.
Wow, and that's because so many times people think of it as, well, pulling the plug, that they're being kept alive by machines. And that's always not necessarily the case. And I think of people, I had a patient when I was a resident who was a young man, and he was in a terrible accident. And interestingly, he didn't initially have a head injury. He had several broken bones. And when you have big broken bones, you get something, not all the time, but sometimes, something called fat embolus. And so he had fat embolus up to his lungs, and they were in terrible shape. And this was kind of at the beginning of CPAP and all these things that they use for ventilatory support now. And he was on the ventilator for, 4 months? And if you think, well, he was being kept alive by a machine, he was. But that didn't mean he was ready to die either. So this, it's like listening to you say everything you're saying is, there's euphemisms, there's talking around it, but the bottom line, you're alive or you're dead.
Yes. And then the kind of patient that you described that has severe injury, multiple injuries, our heart goes out for them. They are a challenge for us doctors to take care of that kind of patient. And so we have concerns in the young man from Oklahoma who was declared brain dead had severe injury, had multiple injuries, multiple fractures of his skull. He was injured in a four-wheeler and that kind of thing. And he was declared brain dead. And he had did not have evidence of circulation to his brain. And so he then became a candidate to have his organs transplanted. But he had a relative, a cousin who was a nurse. The helicopter was landing to take his organs, and the cousin did one more test. Actually, what he did was use the closed pocket knife, and used that firmly on the bottom of his foot and got a response. And then what happened was that they called off the transplant. Or actually, what they did is they made him a candidate for transplant, and in the being a candidate for transplant, they stopped a number of his medications. And in the course of all that, there was then more response, and that kind of Zach Dunlap was his name, by the way, and got a lot of publicity on his case. And Zach Dunlap had an awfully injured head, so that you would say he doesn't have a chance. And yet so I can understand how the doctors would think that he couldn't survive. But in fact, when they did resume treating him after they called off the transplant team, Zach stayed in the hospital for a number of months, but then actually I went to Oklahoma to interview Zach, and he works as a park ranger there. He's after being have this declaration of brain death, he subsequently married, has a child, works as a park ranger. And if he didn't have a cousin that stood up for him, and in the patients that I participated in their care, they have a relative who stands up, and it's the relative who calls attention to the fact that their relative is not dead. Zach was not dead. Jahai was not dead. Joseph was not dead. Aiden was not dead. And there's Penelope and multiple other patients. The boy in Montana who was near drowning and was said to be brain dead, he lives at home with his mother and father. They live on a farm. He has brothers and sisters, but it's a place where they can take care of him, and he continues to live. Oh, it's at least 6 years since he was declared brain dead. Brain death is not death. What they call brain death, it's not death. And what happens is that the patient who's declared brain dead doesn't die from the brain problem. They have the declaration of brain death, and then it's the subsequent action, the action of cutting out their beating heart and their other organs, or the action of turning off a ventilator if they can't take a breath on their own. And incidentally, it came up about the term respirator and ventilator, and it also came up CPAP. I hear you say CPAP, Marilyn, and I say, that reminds me when we didn't have any ventilators for babies when we started. We didn't have any of that. Remember, I started in 63. The first advance we had was CPAP in about 1970. It was so exciting that we had some way to help the babies just a little bit. The respirator gets commonly used. That term gets commonly used. Incidentally, I'm not sure how they used it in the COVID thing, but there was a lot of things in the COVID that there has to be questions about. But the difference between the term respirator the term respirator and ventilator, the machine that we use to support breathing is a ventilator. And what does the ventilator do? It delivers air. That's all it does. It does not respirate anything. Respiration is oxygen in and carbon dioxide out of the lungs and then in all the tissues of the body. The ventilator that we use to support breathing of a patient, a baby, adult. Incidentally, the ventilator that was subsequently invented for the infant is the same ventilator that's used on all ages, because it, for the 2-pound baby, it had to be very precise, it had to be very sensitive. Well, once it was invented for that little baby, it gets used on everybody who gets a ventilator. But to get back to the ventilator, the only thing that the ventilator does is delivers air. It does not do anything else. It makes the air go in. Then the rest of respiration, which is the absorption of oxygen, the circulation of blood, the delivery of oxygen to the tissues, the metabolism, the carbon dioxide. So we need to stop, right?
Carbon dioxide at the end.
Up and then carried by the circulation back to the lungs, then it's the living person that pushes the air, that gets the air to go out. But the ventilator doesn't do that. The ventilator just delivers the air. The ventilator doesn't suck it out. It's the living person that pushes it out. How does that work? And we in medicine are used to thinking in terms of the active part of breathing and the passive part. The active part are the muscles that contract to deliver the air. The passive part is all the rest. And how does it work?
Well, this unfortunately, we have to stop. This is getting to be a really good lesson in how we breathe. And I think what we learn from all this is the body is an entire piece. You can't just parse it apart and say, okay, that part's gone, so the rest of it must be gone, because we now know that that's not true. We didn't even have a chance to get into really the morality of life and death. And with all these discussions, I bring them up. I know they're unpleasant, but people are going to face this. And people have to come to their own decisions and own conclusions. And we try to provide some of the science behind it and some opinions of people who've been around these issues for years. And I thank you, Dr. Byrne. You are just a font of knowledge on this subject. And I'll have to have you back because there's so much more to go into. So thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Marilyn. And we thank God for our blessings and keep doing what we're doing.
Okay. And thank you, everybody, for listening. And I have to remind you that we do have the feature of questions. So if you have any questions, either for the hosts or for the guests, you can send them to americaoutloud.com/pulse. And first names are fine, and we'll send you an email back or answer on the air. And I encourage you to do so. So whether you agree with what you've heard or you have other opinions, please share the show. Thanks again for listening. And until next week, say it loud. I'm free and I'm proud.